There is a huge difference between education and indoctrination. Education is teaching us how to think critically. Indoctrination is telling people what to think. And I would say today our schools are not teaching education, not teaching critical thinking in a real classical education sense, which Christianity has been promoting throughout the Reformation era, but indoctrination, politically correct. This is what you've got to believe. All right-thinking people agree. Nobody in their right mind could disagree. Anyone who disagrees with this is a racist, homophobic, anti-Semitic, Islamophobe, bigot. And, you know, that's not education. That's intimidation and indoctrination. Deuteronomy 6, verse 1 to 9 says, "Now this is the commandment, and these are the statutes and judgments which the Lord your God has commanded to teach you, that you may observe them in the land which you are crossing over to possess, that you may fear the Lord your God, to keep all his statutes and his commandments, which I command you and your son and your grandson, all the days of your life, and that your days may be prolonged. Therefore, hear, O Israel, and be careful to observe it, that it may go well with you, and that you may multiply greatly, as the Lord, the God of your fathers, has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your strength. And these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk on the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. You shall bind them as a sign in your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates." Deuteronomy 6 is immensely important. It comes after the second giving of the law. When God repeats something, it's really important. Deuteronomy 5 gives the law, the Ten Commandments, and in Deuteronomy 6 gives the most important statement on the nature of God, and then it applies it. The first application of these commands is to have them in your heart and to teach them to your children. Education is the first application of this momentous importance of the second giving of the law. And notice, everything we do with our hands is to be governed by the law of God, and everything we think with our mind is to be governed by the word of God. So it's to be on our forehead and on our hands. And on our doorposts and on our gates. That means within our home and within our property, people should see a distinct difference. They should see Christians live differently. And that's why in a Christian home, it's not the TV that's the center. It's got to be the Word of God. It's got to be the library, the bookshelf, the table, the fellowship of the family, the education of children. We're not wanting to have our minds pumped dry and filled with garbage by the world. We're wanting to have them renewed by the Word of God. German reformer Dr. Martin Luther warned us almost 500 years ago, "I am much afraid that schools will prove to be wide gates to hell unless they diligently labor in explaining the Holy Scriptures, engraving them on the hearts of youth. I advise no one to place his child where the Scriptures do not reign paramount. Every institution in which men are not constantly occupied with the Word of God must become corrupt." It is inevitable. Ideas have consequences. There is no such thing as neutral education. Education is either Christian, by definition biblically based and Christ-centered, or it is Islamic, or Hindu, or humanist, or New Age, Marxist. But you don't get neutral education, and it's a complete scam that the secular humanists have managed to convince us that humanism is non-religious or is neutral. Evolutionism is a religion. Secular humanism is a religion. It deifies man, it dethrones God, it makes man's law highest, and in every way, in fact, you know that it's a religion. You can go up to UCT, and amongst the religious associations, they've got the Atheist Society, they've got the Wiccans, they've got the Pagan Society, they've got the Humanist Society, and they're all there listed amongst the religions, and that's right, there are religions. And then why are they the only religion allowed in state schools? You cannot entrust any state with the molding of the minds of the future voters. It's a conflict of interests. The control of education must be in the hands of parents. and the content of education must be moral, character developing, and Bible-based. Education is not pumping a whole lot of information into people's minds. That's not education. The vast majority of what I have found useful and important in my life, I didn't learn at school or at college. And the most important things I learned at school, if I think back to my time in school in Rhodesia, it wasn't the information. It was the character building. It was the discipline. It was being punctual. It was being respectful. It was standing when adults come into the room, tipping a hat to a woman of any age, even if she's in preschool and you're in high school. It doesn't matter. You tip your hat, you show respect, you give your seat. You fingernail inspection, hair inspection. No, your hair mustn't be over your ears. It mustn't touch your ears, mustn't touch your collar. Shoes polished, clothes ironed. The way you filed in and out of the classrooms and the hall, how we sang the hymns. Even I was a pagan and I had no Christian upbringing at school. I heard the gospel read. It didn't seem to have an impact on me because I had a secular family and my mind was blinded. But the hymns that we sung every day at school was not wasted, because the moment I got converted at age 17 in Cape Town, those hymns came flooding back. And for the first time, I understood them. And suddenly they were a revelation. What had just been words and tunes suddenly became spirit and life. And many a time at college, we'd be working our way through the hymn books. Every day we'd stand in academic gowns and be singing hymns. And sometimes I'd say, does anyone know the tune for this one? And often I did. And I hadn't sung it since I'd been converted. But I remembered it from when I was a pagan, unregenerate, secular character at school. But I knew the hymns. And now for the first time, it was overwhelming. So you cannot trust a government to run education. Right now, they're not concerned about character development. They're more concerned about making a fornicating, whoremongering pervert than an educated person of integrity who's respectful to elders and who respects women and who has standards. The most important thing in education, I put it on that sign on our wall there under the clock. We will not lie, steal, or cheat, neither will we tolerate amongst ourselves anyone who does. Now, that's the essence of the character that we were taught at school. We will not lie, steal, or cheat. Neither will we tolerate amongst ourselves anyone who does. That is the honor code. That is the essential core of Western civilized education. Now, today, I mean, they even laugh about, you know, don't get caught and things like that. But there's no integrity left. Now, you see there's a war on history, a war on monuments, and they are taking down monuments. And right now we see in America, they're taking down Confederate monuments of some of the most honorable people, such as General Robert E. Lee, respected and beloved in his own time by even his enemies. But even these statues have to come down. Why? It's not just that they hate whites or hate Confederates or hate history. They hate Christ. And this man was a Christ-like man. And this is primarily an anti-Christian, anti-civilization war. George Orwell, an ex-communist, in his book 1984 says, every record has been destroyed or falsified. Every book rewritten. Every picture has been repainted. Every statue and street building has been renamed. Every date has been altered, and the process is continuing day by day. And minute by minute, history has stopped. Nothing exists except an endless present in which the party is always right. One of the books written by Alexander Solzhenitsyn was, "We never make mistakes." And that's a quote from the Communist Party, because the party is always right. Why? Because the party is God. The party is like the Pope. The Pope is infallible, according to Roman Catholic false doctrine. So the party is always right. If the party decides that it's right, because they are the deification of man. They have, it starts off with mankind is God. And then it becomes the party is God. And after a while it becomes the party leader is God. That's the way they move. Orwell adds, this is the conclusion of 1984, everything faded into mist. The past was erased, the erasure was forgotten, and the lie became truth. That is the goal. Now, why am I quoting from 1984? It was one of my Sedgwick books at school in Rhodesia. They had us study for a whole term, 1984. Another whole term, we studied Animal Farm. I'm so glad they did, because those books weren't just facts. They were teaching you to think critically. Why are these things there? Why did this happen? And you get to understand communism and totalitarianism and socialism. When you understand Animal Farm in 1904, you understand the ideology that has destroyed over 160 million lives in the 20th century alone. And now, when you've read 1984 and Animal Farm, you understand what's going on in America with these clashes between the Black Panthers and the Ku Klux Klan and the war over the monuments. You cannot change your history, but you can learn from it. But they don't want you to learn from it. Because remember, you're not meant to think. Four legs good, two legs bad. And just, bah, follow the herd. And you notice, Wake Up America with a K, Marxism is here. This woman is right. What you're seeing here is Marxism 101. Why? Because Karl Marx said the first battlefield is a rewriting of history. If you may think, what difference does it make taking down statues? Oh, it's very, very, very important to a Marxist. It's their first battlefield. And where did it all start? Cape Town, up the hill, roads must fall. It's bizarre. Not that long ago, February the 1st, 2015, I asked a stream of people walking past this statue, do you know who this is? No. You know who this monument's from? No idea. Not one person I spoke to that day while I was waiting for our trailer to come up for the photo op we were doing with Jamison Hall behind and so on of our pro-life trailer. Nobody knew with it. But just a few days later, nobody could study at UCT because they were so disturbed about the presence of the statue of the man who paid for the campus and who was basically the founder. Roads must fall. They had to wrap it in black plastic bags. And you think, you know, it was a monument. And now it's got black plastic bags around it. And do these students have nothing better to do? All roads lead to colonialism of the mind. Well, who built the roads? And the railway, mind you. When are you removing the statue, UCT? Rise up. Do these students have nothing better to do? Would you want to employ any of these people? I mean, I know quite a lot of folks around, and I don't think I know any employer who'd want to employ these kind of professional, rabble-rousing, troublemaking rioters. These people are unemployable. But don't worry. I mean, 85% of all the students who go to UCT fail to graduate anyway, 85%. And those who do pass, I mean, it's such a miserably low standard, it doesn't mean much anyway. And most of the ones who graduate won't get a job anyway. The vast majority of them are unemployable. Like, what are they studying? Political science and poetry. Like, the country needs more poets and political science majors. They should be studying some trade, engineering, agriculture, anything useful. But no, they've got to study political science, which is like Marxism, and then feminist studies. Oh, that's really going to get you a job. I mean, that's wow. The extraordinary media campaign, the bullying tactics against a monument to the founder of this university, it just undermines education throughout the country. Now, just look at these characters. And I don't know what you see, but if you think that these are the future leaders of the country, I mean, just look at those expressions and look at all these people. Yep. Now, I mean, this, the next CEO of a major company for sure. The most effective way to destroy people is to deny and obliterate their own understanding of their history. Now, why did George Orwell understand this? He is an ex-Marxist. He had been a very enthusiastic communist, but he went to Moscow and he saw Stalin's Russia, and it changed him, and he became an anti-communist. As he says, every record has to be destroyed, every record has to be falsified, every book has to be rewritten, because the party is always right, and anything that contradicts the party has got to go. You've got to have the past erased, and you've got to forget about the erasure, and the lie must become truth. Is that not where we are? Whoever controls the past controls the future, and whoever controls the present controls the past. In other words, if you control the present, you can rewrite the textbooks. Brainwash the next generation so that they will believe the lie. And they'll worship those who hated them and those who despise them. and they'll become just useful idiots for those who loathe them. I mean, don't think that the party for a moment respects any of these pawns, these cannon fodder. They don't care about them. They don't care that they're chasing away their job prospects, chasing away the employers, chasing away the tourists, chasing away the investors, devaluing the rand, eroding the credibility of whatever graduating piece of paper they might get, which, let's face it, only about 15% of them will ever get anyway, and most of those won't even be employable. Do they care? Of course not. Doesn't matter. They're just useful idiots, to quote Vladimir Lenin. And why would you not want people like this on a university campus to damage, to destroy, to vandalize, to destroy even irreplaceable original works of art, oils on canvas? These people couldn't create works of art like this, but they can destroy it. It's not difficult to burn something. It's a lot of effort to produce something beautiful and special. But no, they burn the vehicle, and next thing they'll complain about the problem with the transport. And probably can't see the connection. It's like shooting yourself in the foot, and then shooting yourself in the knee, and then shooting yourself in the groin. And is this really going to help? And is this policeman to blame for whatever this chap's worried about? I mean, is it really his fault? And why on earth would you want to bring people like this into your universities, your communities? And what does looting have to do with freedom? And why would you smash the glass? And is there any point to this? And who's going to pay for it? And who's going to fix it? And who's going to repair it? But this is where we are. And yet they will call all that we've just seen a protest and protesters. They're not protesters, they're rioters. The moment there's violence, it's no longer a protest, it's now a riot. And the damage done to university campuses all over the country, just in 2015, according to our Ministry of Health, Ministry of Education, 300 million rand damage was done on university campuses, according to the General Secretary of the Southern Communist Party, who happens to be the Minister of Higher Education. Oh, in this case, you'll be thrilled to know that the Chancellor of this university in Durban Westville says not much damage was done. He's glad that the damage was slight. Yeah, just the library and so on. But I don't suppose he knows what a book is, at least not from the inside. UCT will pay? That's not true. The taxpayer pays. It's not UCT, maybe their parents and taxpayers, but it's not UCT's not paying for anything. Now, when I was a privileged white in apartheid South Africa in 1982, I entered Baptist Theological Seminary. Not that I got it free. I worked at the fire brigade 6 days a week, 8 hours a night, often coming in smelling of smoke, but I was working for putting myself through college because being too male and too pale in 1982... as a privileged white, you know, all the black and colored people could be at college on bursaries, but whites couldn't, and that was then. Now, they speak about people like me as the previously advantaged, and I'm not too sure what advantage we had. We were conscripted, well, we were caned at school, we were beaten in the army, we were conscripted, not just 2 years full-time national service, but 10 years part-time, 2 to 3 months a year for the next 10 years, and that was white privilege, oh, and we paid the taxes too. And we fund ourselves through college. And the previously disadvantaged, oh, they were the ones who got their electricity free, their plumbing free, their housing free, their education. They weren't conscripted and they weren't caned and beaten like we were at schools. Okay. This is George Orwell 1984, Newspeak, where they changed terminology. And now you don't need to worry because we're free. You've heard of the beer belly? These are the BEE bellies. Black economic empowerment, affirmative action, and yep. Do you remember when the police used to be smart and when you used to respect people in government? It's very hard to even remember. Remember when people used to fear the police and respect private property? And this is somehow meant to make things better. Time for educated leaders. We are the future. I mean, what are you meant to do? Laugh? Vomit? I mean, really, they're the future? Educate modern education, creating people who are smart enough to accurately repeat what they're told and follow orders, dumb enough to think this makes them smarter than everyone else. R.C. Sproul says this could be the dumbest generation in history. Because don't let the technology fool you. People used to be able to sit and listen to multiplied hour speeches. There's examples like the 4.5-hour presidential debates, highly integrated between Lincoln and Douglas, and 4.5 hours, and there's no evidence that the people thought this was getting too long-winded, and you read it and you think you've got to be kidding. They're spending hours arguing over parts of words. And the sermons, you read some of the Puritan sermons from the 1600s, unbelievably detailed. You try and preach this in an average third-year theological college, the guys won't even understand it. It's so high. It presupposes a knowledge of obscure characters in the Bible that most of us haven't heard of. Even people who've graduated from college are like, huh? What's he referring to? They obviously had more educated congregations in the rural areas back then than we have in our universities and our theological seminaries or cemeteries today. This, by the way, is Claremont, now Cape Town, this week. Yep, this really is going to help. This is meant to be a tourist area, and this is in Baltimore, in America. Black people protesting against a black majority town where the mayor's black and the head of the police is black, and they say they're victims of racism. Even duct tape can't fix stupid, but it can muffle the sound. Duct tape is extremely useful, and I think for many of them, duct taping them might be a good beginning. Hosea 4 verse 6. We know the first phrase, but most people don't get the whole context. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. Knowledge is important, but notice the whole context. My people are destroyed from lack of knowledge. Because you have rejected knowledge, I will also reject you as my priests. Because you've ignored the law of your God, I will also ignore your children. Why is our society in such a mess? Why do we have what seems to be a cursed, lost generation? It's lack of knowledge. And knowledge begins with the fear of God. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And they say education is a powerful tool, but they don't know anything about education. It's obvious. If they knew about education, they wouldn't be involved in this kind of destruction. What they are victims of is indoctrination. And calling education indoctrination doesn't make it education. Think of the people going into higher education with all kinds of aspirations, dreams, creativity, and potential. And how they come out? Rioters, useless drug addicts, criminals. What on earth is happening inside? Well, you came from nothing. You're going nowhere. Life is meaningless. From goo to the zoo to you. From mud to molecules to monkeys to man. And a whole lot of nothing and a whole lot of time made everything. Really? And there's no such thing as right and wrong, but all the Christians are wrong and God is wrong and God doesn't exist, but we hate him. And all of these things that are just poured into them, and after years of this, and you don't pass unless you regurgitate the garbage that you meant to. You get into deep trouble if you give creative, honest answers. I mean, just in my own limited experience, I remember I came down from Rhodesia where we had a very high level of education. And I must say, while the South African science and maths was better, the Rhodesian history and geography and English was higher. And in history, there was one question in matric, for my matric exam, discuss the causes of the Second World War. And I thought, this is great. And I mean, my arm was aching at the end because I had been writing so fast. And I thought, yeah, I poured everything in. I got a zero. And the teacher said, that wasn't what we taught you. And so I asked for a remark, and I got a 98%. From 0 to 98% is not bad. It sounds like a cheetah accelerating over 3 seconds. But the point was, I gave an answer that wasn't the textbook answer. But that's what we were taught to do in Rhodesia. We were taught to think outside the box and don't regurgitate textbook. My history teacher is a member of parliament, Mr. Rhys Davies, said, beware the victor's version. Never regurgitate the textbook. Think outside the box. Always ask why. Which I did. I quoted sources, A.J.P. Taylor and this and that, and I had my facts down and so on, and Versailles Treaty. But they didn't like my answer, and so the teacher gave a zero, but the remark gave an A+. So it just goes to show, that was 1977. Already you could see indoctrination coming in. Now indoctrination is lock, stock, and barrel buried in cement. I mean, kids at school get into deep trouble if they think. The seven pillars of higher education in South Africa today, but we'll call it by its correct name, ignorance, ideology, incompetence, nepotism, unaccountability, laziness, arrogance, corruption. Are those not the seven pillars of education, so-called, in South Africa today? Boy, are the ANC arrogant, and are they corrupt? I mean, they've got the A and they've got the C right there. Unbelievable. Oh, and an N for nepotism, too. Like this funny character up at UCT saying we've got to abolish science, and then she opens her iPad. I don't think she fully sees the connection. And she says we need to forget about Western science and get science from our traditional healers and the witch doctors. Like, yeah, no, this is really going to be an improvement. Okay, here's five truths you can't disagree with. You cannot legislate the poor into prosperity, and you cannot legislate the wealthy out of prosperity. But if you went around now into a poverty-stricken squatter camp and you gave R1 million to each person, would you solve their problem?
No.
Not long term, because it wouldn't take very long for the people to be in a worse state. And they proved it, because in Britain they did the study on 14 people who'd won the lottery. Now, the lottery in Britain is millions of pounds each. And pounds, you know, are like 16, 17, 18 rand to the pound. Although the first time I went to Britain, I got more pounds than for my rand, because the rand was more powerful than the pound. But that was back in the evil days. Now we're free. So of these people who've been made instant millionaires from the lottery, every single one of them was worse off. Every one of them. And it just goes to show, easy come, very, very, very easy go. What one person receives without working for, another person must work for without receiving. There's no such thing as a free lunch. The government cannot give to anyone anything the government doesn't first take from somebody else. You cannot multiply wealth by dividing it. When half of the people get the idea that they don't have to work because the other half is going to take care of them, and the other half gets the idea that it does no good to work because someone else is going to get what they work for, that's the beginning of the end of any nation. When the people who vote for a living outnumber the people who work for a living, country's on an economic, suicidal, slippery slope. Now, if you bring facts like this, you'll get your poor liberal friends crying because they don't like you using facts. Don't raise your voice, improve your argument. I mean, many people, when they don't have anything there, they start screaming and going berserk, intimidating. Well, that doesn't improve the argument. I would like to apologize to anyone I've not yet offended. Please be patient, I'll get to you shortly. I was told by the missionary I was mentored by, Francis Grimm, that a missionary must comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. Democracy, the means by which those who adore authority and crave the security of servitude, can use their superior numbers to enslave those who wish to be free. Have you noticed how these poor Democrats in America got absolutely distraught over the victory of the other candidate? They never thought, after wanting more and more and more and more and more and more intrusive government and centralized power, that would fall in hands someone they don't like or agree with. Surely the solution is decentralized, so that whoever's in power can't mess up your life. The more decentralized, the better. George Orwell says, if liberty means anything at all, it means the right to tell people what they don't want to hear. In the Middle Ages, to shut people up, to intimidate people into silence, all you had to do in a church was scream heresy, or in a state to scream treason. Because for both those, you either got burned at stake or had your head chopped off. So it had a lot of terror, intimidation factor behind it. You just call a person a heretic, don't even need much proof, or a traitor, and I mean, you shut them up. Just the fear of being called a heretic or traitor would shut people up. But today, what is it? Hate speech, bigot, intolerant, homophobic bigot is better, Islamophobe, anti-Semite, hate speech. I mean, this is the modern equivalent of heresy and treason. And you don't even need logic or facts to prove your accusation. Just merely suggesting that the person is a racist or intolerant or hate speech or a homophobic bigot is enough to make most people whimper and cower into the corner. like a whipped puppy. I mean, shocking. If you accept restrictions on free speech for any reason, it means you didn't have an education, you had an indoctrination. But you see this. You see this with the children coming back from the schools. What are they getting? They're getting an indoctrination. They've got to this and that and so on. And the moment you come up with something else, say, well, that's racist. You go through the facts again and that's intolerant. But look at the facts. But they're not. They can't look at the facts. They've been pre-programmed like Pavlov's dogs. You ring the bell, and they've got to salivate. I mean, there's this is Pavlovian response. They've been trained and trained. And basically, it's as, you know, good boy when you do the right thing, and you get an electric shock when you do the wrong thing. They've got ways of punishing nonconformity. As my history teacher continually reminds us, beware the victor's version. They lie. Wartime propaganda morphs into peacetime textbooks. Charlton Heston, one of the very few conservatives who survived in Hollywood, said, political correctness is just tyranny with manners. I wish for you the courage to be unpopular. Popularity is history's pocket change. Courage is history's true currency. Courage is gold. Political correctness is cheap. And if you want to be popular, you will be unpopular with God, because to be a friend of the world is to be the enemy of God. Plato, 2,400 years ago, could say, strange times are these in which we live, when old and young are taught falsehoods in school, and the person that dares to call it the truth is called at once a lunatic and a fool. Aristotle observed 2.5 millenniums ago, tolerance and apathy are the last virtues of a dying society. He saw that in Greece. Greece was once the greatest civilization in the world. It was dying from tolerance and apathy. And the last terminal stage of any civilization is sexual perversion. When sexual perversion becomes accepted, and the terminal stage of that is the public acceptance of homosexuality, and at that point, the society is on its way to doom. Because the family and raising the next generation children is the absolute lifeblood of civilization. Without that, you don't have civilization. Now, James Kennedy said, every school you see, public or private, religious or secular, is a visible reminder of the religion of Jesus Christ. So is every college and every university. Can anyone identify this college? Country? City? It's the Academy of Calvin in Geneva. And this college here? This is called Christ Church. It's one of the 30-odd colleges of Oxford, one of the oldest, most prestigious Christ College. Christ Church, that's the and you can see the cathedral is part of the quadrangle of the college itself. Oxford is not one university. It's actually 33 universities, and Christ Church is one of the most prestigious of them. Dr. James Kennedy and Jerry Newcomb document in the What If Jesus Had Never Been Born book that the phenomenon of education for the masses had its roots in Christianity. The pursuit of the knowledge of God in a systematic, philosophical, and in-depth way gave rise to the phenomenon of universities all around the world. It's the Christian faith that gave rise to the very idea of higher learning. Uni veritas, one truth. The very etymology of the word in Latin shows its Christian origin. University, one truth. Pagans don't even believe there's one truth. Secular humanists don't. So to be consistent, they should open up polyversities, diversities, and aversities. But a university, by definition, should be Christian. We should reclaim those campuses for Christ. Christianity is a tremendous force for education. Most of the world's languages were first set to writing by Christian missionaries, like the Tswana language or the Zulu. All languages in Africa actually got their alphabet and the written languages from the missionaries, and their first book was the Bible. Christianity has been the greatest force for promoting literacy worldwide throughout history. The greatest professor of the greatest university at that time, Professor John Wycliffe of Oxford University, sent out the field workers of the Reformation, the Lollards, who sowed the seeds that led to the Reformation in just over a century's time. The Christian missionary movement in the 19th century pioneered tens of thousands of schools throughout Africa, Asia, and the Pacific Islands, providing education for countless millions, even in the remotest jungles, giving the gift of literacy to tribes who had never before had a written language. This picture, by the way, I was ordered to take down in Kirchentag in Frankfurt, 1987. I was in Germany with a stand for United Christian Action. And this is a picture at Dingaanstad, or Ungungunglovo. This is a Dutch form missionary leading some blind children in a chain across the local river. I was told that picture's paternalistic. Paternalism means fatherly. That used to be a good term. I think it still is, or it should be. But paternalism is now a swear word to the New World Order. This at the same mission, at Ungungungluwe, Dutch form mission, helping this little girl to walk. At the same mission, Ungungungluwe, Dutch form mission, providing education for the deaf. And this is a special high-intensity way of teaching them, extraordinarily advanced for the time. Of course, missions have been providing Bibles and books and libraries and literacy. And this is the high school we established in South Sudan, Christian Liberty High School in Mundri. There is no doubt that Jesus Christ was the greatest teacher the world has ever known. When he spoke, they were astonished at his teaching, for he taught them as one having authority. Jesus didn't need footnotes, bibliography, and sources, because he was the authority. I mean, he is the definitive authority. The life, the teachings, and the example of Jesus Christ have profoundly influenced the whole development of education worldwide. The great commission of our Lord Jesus Christ was to make disciples of all nations, teaching them. Teaching is a vital part of the Great Commission. And the apostles took the commands and the example of our Lord Jesus Christ very seriously. They did not cease teaching. One of the biblical requirements for elder or Christian leaders, he must be able to teach. From the very beginning, Christians were establishing schools. And those who sought to become members of the Christian church went through a 2 or 3 year training program where they were catechized. That's the origin of the catechism, that they had to be able to understand the answers to all these different key questions of the faith. In the 2nd century AD, Justin Martyr, who died for the faith, and it's his surname that's now given the term martyrdom and dying for your faith, he established the catechetical schools in Ephesus and Rome. Clement established an excellent school in Alexandria, the second greatest city in the world at the time after Rome, and certainly the greatest city in all of Africa. Prominent Christian leaders like Origen and Athanasius were graduates of the Alexandrian school. The school at Alexandria taught doctrine, mathematics, medicine, and grammar. By the way, this library in the end had 6 million scrolls and books by the 6th century. And when the Muslims arrived, they burned down the Library of Alexandria, the greatest library the world had ever seen. 6 million books and scrolls. And although Muhammad had already died, they followed his instructions. He said, when you take Alexandria, if the books confirm what's in Islam, we don't need them. And if they don't confirm what's in the Quran, we don't want them. So just burn it. Burn the library. And this is the great religion of learning. And they burned the greatest library in the world. By the 4th century, church and cathedral schools maintained by pastors teaching Christian doctrine, grammar, rhetoric, logic, arithmetic, medicine, music, geometry, astronomy, were normal. And amongst the many innovations in Christian education was that these Christian schools were for everybody. Girls, women, males, females. This is complete Christian innovation. Because as W.M. Ramsey concluded, Christian aimed at universal education, not education confined to the rich, as amongst the Greeks and Romans, and made no distinction of sex. St. Augustine observed Christian women were better educated than pagan male philosophers, who were the most highly educated in the pagan world. The Greeks and Romans, before the birth of Christ, did not formally educate girls. Only boys from the privileged classes obtained an education, so it was very much an elite. Maybe 5% of the population could read and write. That was it. But Christianity revolutionized education by making it available to all classes and to both genders. The secular historian who hated Christianity, Will Durant, wrote that early Christianity offered itself without reservation to all individuals, to all classes, and to all nations. It was not limited to one people like Judaism, nor the freed men of one state, like the official cults of Greece and Rome. So that's in Caesar and Christ by Will Durant. So even he recognized that. King Alfred the Great of England in the 9th century ensured that both his sons and daughters obtained a thorough education, including in Latin. And he promoted church schools throughout the kingdom. Here in Wantage, where King Alfred the Great was born, his monument says, Alfred found learning dead and restored it, education neglected, and he revived it. The laws powerless, and he gave them force. The church debased, and he raised it. A land ravaged by a fearful enemy, from which he delivered it. The German reformer Martin Luther taught that cultivating the human mind was absolutely essential because people need to understand what the word of Scripture and the nature of the world in which the word would take root. We've got to study the word of God and the works of God. Special revelation in the Bible, natural revelation in creation. Martin Luther said parents who failed to teach their children were shameful and despicable. His catechism was to him the most important production. When he is asked of his 400 titles, 60,000 pages of published works, which are your most important books, he was asked at the end of his life. And he said, I'd rather all my books be forgotten than the scriptures alone be read. And then he had, but I'd like the catechism to remain. So what he wrote to explain the scriptures to children, he saw as more important than all his theological works. Luther, in fact, wanted a system of education as free and unrestricted as the gospel he preached, indifferent, like the gospel, to distinctions of sex or of social class, rich or poor, peasants or nobles. Doesn't matter, male or female, they all need education. But they meant real education. The reformer John Calvin also advocated universal education. When it comes to universal education, Christians were centuries. In fact, Christians were almost two millenniums ahead of the pagans. The pagans have not been for universal education until very, very recently. Calvin's Geneva Plan included a system of elementary education in the vernacular, that's the common language, for all, including reading, writing, arithmetic, grammar and religion, and the establishment of secondary schools for the purpose of training citizens for civil and ecclesiastical leadership. John Comenius pioneered schools in Bohemia, teaching schools about God, man, and nature. Political leaders harbored a distrust of formal book learning. The idea that every child should attend school did not originate from any secular authorities, but from Christian reformers like Luther, Melanchthon, Comenius, and John Calvin. Graded levels of education was first introduced in the 16th century by a German Lutheran layman, Johann Sturm, who believed that this system would motivate students to study because they'd be rewarded by advancing to the next level. Sturm introduced the gymnasium, literally gym for the mind, in Strasbourg, 1538. Kindergartens were first established by Friedrich Froebel. Froebel was a devout Christian who believed the world of man and nature was connected by God. And so, son of a German Lutheran pastor, he developed the idea of a child growing under the care of an expert gardener or teacher, like a children's garden, hence the word Kindergarten. And because he'd often helped his father in the family garden to help what you had to do to train and guide plants and trees and creepers and so on to grow and flourish and how you trim and so on. And so he's thinking, we need to be training the young well. And so they need a kindergarten. This is, again, a thoroughly Christian Lutheran concept. Education for the deaf was also pioneered by Christians. Charles Lapierre developed a sign language for formally teaching the deaf in 1775. Thomas Galdut, a Congregational clergyman, opened the first school for the deaf in America in 1817. Galdut taught not only the three R's, but also fourth R, religion, reading, writing, arithmetic, and religion, so that deaf people could read, write, and communicate what was most important. Before Jesus Christ, human life in the Greek and Roman Empire was extremely cheap. Infants born with physical defects like blindness were commonly abandoned to die in the wilderness. In ancient Greece, blind babies were cast into the sea. Boys who survived the blind childhood or became blind later in life usually became galley slaves, rowing boats. And blind girls were commonly assigned to a life of prostitution. That's the kind of callousness they had before the time of Christ. But our Lord showed particular compassion for the blind. He healed many blind individuals during his ministry on earth. And when the Roman persecution church ended in the 4th century, Christians established asylums for the blind. In the 19th century, Louis Braille, a dedicated Christian who had lost his eyesight at age 3, developed his own alphabet system of pinpricked raised dots that the fingers could read. He gave the world of the blind 6 embossed dots, 3 high, 2 wide, for each letter of the alphabet. He attended church every Sunday, and while still a teenager, became a proficient church organist. On his deathbed, Braille said, "I'm convinced that my mission is finished on earth. I tasted yesterday the supreme delight. God condescend to brighten my eyes in the splendor of eternal hope." It was Braille's vision that enables millions of blind people to read with their fingers. And I don't know if you've run your fingers over Braille Bibles and some of the Braille signs you've got in some lifts and so on, and you think, how do they make sense of this? Because you've got to be really astute. But of course, when one sense is taken, others compensate. The Industrial Revolution in the 18th century led to the widespread practice of child labor in British factories. As we know, Mary Slessor, David Livingstone, his children, they were working 14 hours a day in the factory 6 days a week. That was common. But Robert Raikes, a printer by trade, felt led to help children of the poor by teaching them on Sundays. The only day off they had was Sundays. Hence, Sunday school was not to babysit the children of Christian parents when they go to church on Sunday. It was to educate and reach the children who had no other means of education. Yes, children were working 12 hours a day, or in the case of Livingstone, 14, 6 days a week, but they were free on Sundays. So Robert Raikes began his first Sunday school, 1780. Boys and girls came from some of the poorest homes and learned the skill of reading and the riches of the Bible in these Sunday schools, which were soon very widespread. And by the way, I've seen this being practiced in Britain on recent speaking tours. I saw in Birmingham that the churches on the Sunday afternoons, just about everyone in the church is expected to take part in Sunday school, which would be generally to try and reach unsaved children in neighborhoods by teaching them English or reading, writing, and so on in the church, and that would be in the afternoons. So that's interesting that you're seeing this continuing to some degree. Although the Greeks and Romans had their philosophers, their poets, and their gifted thinkers before the time of Christ, there were no permanent institutions of learning, no libraries, no guilds of schools or students, no educational research institutions, and the inductive method was both ignored and spurned. So when people speak about, the ancient Greek and Roman universities, no, they were not universities. They might have been schools, but the term university dates from the 12th century. Universities grew out of the monastic missionary centers. The first monastery established at Monte Cassino in 428 AD, elaborate library systems were developed, sadly blown to pieces by the Allies in the Second World War. The monks who were effectively the missionaries who discipled Europe collected the books and copied the manuscripts. The monks were required to read books daily. So indispensable were libraries to the Benedictine order that the library is said to be the monastery's armory, like the armory of a castle. The first universities in Paris, Oxford, Cambridge in the 13th century taught theology, law, and medicine. They called theology the queen of the sciences. And the first university lectures were the missionaries, the monks, who came from a long-standing tradition of doing both physical work and intellectual work. And that's why Cambridge has a big red cross as a symbol, and their main university is called Christchurch, again, right here. Monks were used to getting dirt under fingernails. Therefore, from the start, these universities combined manual and intellectual activity. University students were expected to work in the gardens. And there was dissecting of human cadavers for forensic research and anatomical studies, if you were studying medicine, for example. Researching the scriptures and original Greek manuscripts and classical texts in Latin, as Luther and as Zwingli would have had to do. The empirical research which characterized these first universities grew out of the medieval monasteries, where manual work and academic study were seen as complementary. So most universities began as Christian schools. Harvard University, established in 1636, Yale University, both congregational. Princeton University was started as a Presbyterian college. Oxford and Cambridge were, of course, Anglican. Heidelberg and Basel, that was found by the Lutheran and by the Reformed. And you can see the church spires dominating the landscape of these universities. the churches were at the very center. The chapels were a core part of university studies. This is Oxford. And every one of these colleges has their chapel or church or cathedral as the center part of their academic institutions. And you can see why it's important to obliterate history and monuments for these secular humanists. And magnificent traditions. But they might look, wrap themselves in the same garment, but what they're now teaching in Oxford is not the gospel or biblical teaching. When you go here to just look at the different schools at Oxford, the School of Grammar and History, the School of Morals and Philosophy, of course all in Latin, and the School of Medicine and of Music and of Logic. That's not a very popular subject today. Look at some of these ancient libraries that he gets in Oxford, just magnificent. All these books, centuries old. The greatest invention in the field of human learning, the printing press by Johannes Gutenberg, was also fruit of the Christian faith. The first book to be printed, obviously the Bible. So it's ironic how many people in high institutes of learning today are so hostile towards Christianity. Because perhaps they're ignorant that the Christian roots of universal education for all classes and both genders and the incomparable contribution of Christianity to worldwide literacy, graded education, higher education. The very name of university testifies to its Christian origins. So just remind your friends, Uni Veritas. What does that stand for? One truth. Yet the average university professor today doesn't even believe there is a truth, let alone that can be known. So isn't it time that teachers, lecturers, professors took an in-depth look at the greatest teacher the world's ever known, the greatest book the world's ever produced, the faith that's inspired and pioneered every single branch of education and science? So campuses should be reclaimed for Christ. We will not hide them from their children. We will tell the next generation the praiseworthy deeds of the Lord, which he commanded our forefathers to teach their children so that the next generation would know them, even the children yet to be born. And they in turn would tell their children. Then they'd put their trust in God and would not forget his deeds, but would keep his commands. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Now, real education is what you read. You are what you read. Grades don't measure intelligence. Age doesn't define maturity. Stepping stones to success are books. Some years ago, George and Alec Gallup undertook an exhaustive investigation as to what makes some people more successful than others. And using the polling techniques that made them famous, the brothers researched and wrote a book, and one of their conclusions was successful people read. It provides foundations for constructive conversation. Reading is essential because it makes a person ready to converse, to communicate. People who read have a broad knowledge. People who read have more information with which to make evaluations and decisions. A library is actually a gym for the mind. Reading is to the mind what exercise is for the body. Books are minds alive on the shelves. You get inspiration from examples of excellence, and we can hear the voices of people far away in time and space. By reading, we can hear great people of long ago speaking to us, mind to mind and heart to heart. If it was announced that Martin Luther was speaking at a particular church, or that John Calvin was speaking at a particular venue, or if it was announced that Charles Spurgeon was speaking anywhere, if it was announced that David Livingstone was speaking at an event, many Christians from all over the world would find their way there and they would turn up. But we need to remember that when we open up a book by one of those authors, we can hear them speak. And we can learn from them in a greater way than you could if you just heard them at a single meeting. It's character shaping. A man is known by the company he keeps. It's also true a person's character is to a large extent developed by the books he or she reads. A man is known by the company his mind keeps, and a book is good company. We need to learn from the past. The reading of all good books is like conversation with the finest minds of past centuries. Interesting design, but points is this is soul food. In books lies the soul of the whole past time. And it gives you an advantage. Mark Twain observed, the man who does not read good books has no advantage of the man who cannot read them. The things I want to know are in books. My best friend is the person who will get me a book I have not read. It's treasure. Walt Disney said, there's more treasure in books than on all the pirates' loots on Treasure Island. The best of all, you can enjoy these riches every day of your life. Now, he had a good reason for saying that. Every one of his most successful films came from classic old books. Sleeping Beauty. All the different Grimm's fairy tales and so on. I mean, he got it all there, and this is what enabled him, Jungle Book and so on. So Walt Disney found real treasure in these old books, did he not? Interesting. That, by the way, is meant to be a bath. In a very real sense, people who've read good literature have lived more than people who cannot or will not read. It's not true you only have one life to live. If we can read, we can live as many more lives and as many kinds of lives as we wish. And it provides us with secrets for success. If we encounter a man of rare intellect, we should ask him what books he reads. I've regularly asked some most important people I've ever met, what are your favorite books? And it's always intriguing to hear. Nobody has the same list, except the Bible's on everyone's list, but aside from that. Charles Spurgeon counseled his students, master the books that you have, read them thoroughly, bathe in them until they saturate. You read and reread them, digest them. A student will find his mental constitution is more affected by one book thoroughly mastered than by 20 books he's merely skimmed. And we need to choose wisely. Daniel Webster recommended it's better to master a few books than to read indiscriminately. It was his contention that to master a few great writers is preferable to skimming a multitude of lesser works. And let me say today, our danger is not so much choosing lesser books, although there's that too, but choosing the newspaper, TV, and just all kinds of mindless, superficial chitter-chatter on the internet to some great books. We need to take control of our time and make sure that books are part of our life, because these are truths that have endured. The tried and tested is better than the current fashion. C.S. Lewis recommended, if you must read only the new or the old, I would advise read rather the old. It's good rule after reading a new book never to allow oneself another new one until you've read an old one in between. There's a reason for this. I read old books because I'd rather learn from those who built civilization than from those who tore it down. The 20th century is filled with people who tore down or stood by while nothing was done while it was torn down. Reject the shallow, reject the superficial. Inferior books are to be rejected in an age and a time when we courted by whole libraries. Or worse. You've been lied to about everything. The illiterate of the 21st century are not those who cannot read or write, but those who cannot unlearn the many lies they've been taught to believe. I heard Ronald Reagan once, personally. I was on my first visit to America in January 1988, I was in D.C., where he was speaking at National Religious Broadcasters, and Ronald Reagan said there, it's not that our liberal democratic friends are uneducated. It's just that so much of what they know just isn't so. And that's so true. And the word schooling is quite good, because many people have been schooled, but they haven't been educated. They've been indoctrinated. They haven't been educated. They've learned to think in a certain way, but they haven't learned to think. They have been, it's like being put on a railway track. You're only allowed to go on this railway track. You can't four-wheel drive off and make new paths. You've got to go on this railway track. A child who reads will be an adult who thinks. The best thing my parents taught me is how to read. And they taught me to read and to love reading. And I could read before I went to school. And my parents, I remember at night, we'd sit around and we'd be reading. And book reading was a normal part of our upbringing. What a privilege and a joy. Reading to children, even before they can understand the words, teaches them to associate books with love and affection. I've read with all of my children long before they could read or understand anything. Every night be reading time, then sitting there and, you know, often just pointing to different animal pictures and giving the sound for it and then repeating the sounds. But they associate reading time with just, it was a time of fun. Savor the special. No man's life is long enough to read even all those things which are good and great and famous. So we should select the superlative. Why should we waste our time with lesser works when some of the greatest are available? Some books are to be tasted, others to be swallowed, and a few are to be chewed and digested. Read the best books first, or you may not have the chance to read them at all. It's preparation for life. And by the way, you notice cats and dogs like people who read. A lap, that's stationary. Sometimes having a purring, sleeping cat on my lap has made me read more. I might have gotten up otherwise. Many times a reading of a book has made the future of a man. I know sometimes when I've been praying on my knees and the cat suddenly made a bed on the back of my legs and I'm going to stay a bit longer. What else is there to pray about? So your pets and your books go together. Employ your time in improving yourself by other men's writing so that you will come easily by what others have labored hard for. Next to the Holy Scriptures, the greatest aid to life of faith may be Christian biographies, said A.W. Tozer. The reading of good biography forms an important part of a Christian's education. It provides him with numberless illustrations for use in his own service. He learns to assess the true worth of character, to glimpse a work goal for his life, to decide how best to attain it, what self-denial is needed to curb unworthy aspirations, and all the time he learns how God breaks into dedicated lives to bring about his own purposes. And that's why we need to focus on those who change the world. Biography transmits personality. And this is why I have focused on Great Ascension of Missions, 19 biographies of 19 great missionaries in the 19th century. Great Ascension of Reformation, 16 biographies and 16 great reformers of the 16th century. Victorious Christians have changed the world, going from Perpetua to Mary Slessor, and so on. Who can gauge inspiration to the cause of missions of great biographies like those of William Carey, Adoniram Judson, Hudson Taylor, Charles Studd? And it has impact. History is but the lengthy shadow of great men. Enrich your life, your work, your family, and your ministry. This is Juliet, my daughter Andrea's cat. Those who love reading have everything within their reach. For a small price, you can visit other lands and great periods of history, learn from some of the greatest minds and world shapers, grapple with great issues, and learn in a space of a few hours what others have grappled with, researched, and studied for their whole lives. Ordinary people have big TVs. Extraordinary people have big libraries. At another time, I'll look at some of the most important books in history, but I believe a person who loves reading will know more than all their teachers. In fact, there's a verse that says that in Psalm 119. A person who knows God's law knows more than all their teachers. A person who loves reading can know more than all the professors. You can get more benefit from books than you can from a university degree. In fact, it was James Kennedy who said, understand the times. If you master understanding the times, he said, it will be better than any college degree. That's James Kennedy, who had a lot of degrees. And speaking to Professor, Doctor, Advocate, Reverend Germany, Francis Nigel Lee, who had something like 14 doctorates, 26 degrees, certainly the most over-educated man I knew in the world. He said to me, there's not a degree in the world that needs more than 18 months. But he says they pad it and drag it out so that they can sell more books, get more money out of the students, that they can have time for the parties and all the other nonsense there. He says he is convinced that they have padded and dragged out almost every degree course to feed the industry. But it's not needed if you focus. And we discovered this in homeschooling. You can, in a morning, achieve more education than they'll do in the average week in the average classroom. In fact, I'm convinced one day spent at the Ark Encounter or the Creation Museum, you'll learn more than you'll learn in probably a year in a public school. There's no doubt. If you're talking about real education, I know that was true when I was taking my children around the country, going to some of the museums, the monuments, going to some of the battle sites and learning from other cultures and visiting different mission sites. You can learn a lot more feet on the ground or from reading good books. It's extraordinary. I think the word education has been so hijacked and abused. But let's think of it, what they're doing as indoctrination and schooling. It's not really education. They've lied. It's, in fact, the terms are like Newspeak in 1984. The Ministry of Plenty runs starvation and rationing. The Ministry of Peace runs perpetual war. The Ministry of Truth twists everything into lies and runs a propaganda. The Ministry of Love deals with the torture of people. Everything is inverted, which is true. I mean, isn't that the way it works? Do you know what KGB stood for in America, in Russia? The in Russian, the KGB, the secret police who tortured and murdered millions, it stood for Department of Homeland Security. That's what KGB stood for in Russian language. Department, how, sounds pleasant. Che Guevara, who murdered thousands of people personally, his ministry in Cuba was the Ministry of Home Affairs. No, Ministry of Internal Affairs. Ministry of Internal Affairs, you'd think he's running the forestry department or something. But that was the term for the people who ran the concentration camps and the firing squads. They have innocuous names for evil, evil things. And so when I speak about education, it's not education. It's indoctrination.